We are here as a community of one for you. We will be here to help you through this horrific episode. Squirrel Hill is the most diverse neighborhood in all of Western Pennsylvania. People choose to live there because of the diversity of the community. The Jewish community is the backbone. It is part of the fabric of Pittsburgh, and we will be there in all communities to support our friends in the Jewish community.
Hey, what's up? Welcome to In the Thick. This is a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
And that voice that you heard at the top of the show is Bill Peduto, who called Saturday's mass shooting in a synagogue the darkest day in the city's history. An anti-Semitic gunman entered the Tree of Life synagogue. He killed 11 people during a morning service. And according to the Anti-Defamation League, this is the deadliest attack on the Jewish community inside the United States ever in history. So in order to help us understand and to mourn and to process, we have two special guests today. Calling in from Detroit is native Pittsburgher Brenton Mock. He's a staff writer at City Lab. Hey, Brenton.
Hey, great. Thanks for having me on. Thank you.
And joining us in our studio in Harlem is our ITT expert in hate groups, Mike German. He's a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program and a former FBI agent. Welcome back, Mike.
Thanks for having me again.
So, Brenton, it was in your city in Pittsburgh where this happened. And the way that you write about your city and about Squirrel Hill, where this attack took place, is kind of beautiful. So you say that basically in Pittsburgh, it's pretty much a black and white situation. And then you say, except when you get to Squirrel Hill, where cosmopolitan crowds, not all college students, many of them business owners, swirl regularly. It's where you might find Lena's Palestinian food truck selling falafel parked in front of the Orthodox Share Torah Congregation Synagogue, which you say is an indicator of just how open and welcoming the Jewish people can be in their, quote unquote, in their neighborhood. So just, Brenton, how you doing? I mean, this is your neighborhood. You're a native Pittsburgher. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. It's, I feel like the shock hasn't totally set in. Even though I was literally driving through Squirrel Hill, as these events were unfolding. But, as a journalist, you kind of sometimes, unfortunately, have to learn this practice of kind of disassociation, emotional disassociation, so that you can have clear enough thoughts to process what's happening. And, I'm still in that processing mode. So, otherwise I'm doing good.
I gotta say, it sounds like you're in a little bit of shock.
It's quite shocking. Given what I know, about Squirrel Hill intimately, as I lived there for many years, it's just one of these places where you wouldn't believe that something like this would happen. And yet at the same time, all facts and kind of political climate considered, it's kind of unfortunately inevitable that this was the place that that something like this would happen.
You know, Brenton, what makes it so special? I know you wrote about it, but I'd love to hear your words about why Squirrel Hill is so unique in the context of Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I mean, Pittsburgh is a very segregated city, mainly along black and white lines, if you will. You have several African-American neighborhoods, such as the Hill District, which is the subject of the noted playwright August Wilson's plays. But most of your neighborhoods are pretty, they're predominantly white. If you're someone who is coming from a city with relatively more diversity, like in New York City, Washington, D.C., Atlanta, or New Orleans, all cities that I've lived in. And, if you come to Pittsburgh kind of looking for the chance to exchange and dialogue and rub elbows with people from various nationalities, it's really hard to find that. in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And Squirrel Hill is the, by far, it's the main exception to that. You know, again, it is this Jewish neighborhood in the sense that this is where the concentration of most of your Jewish institutions are. But because of its location, which is kind of, it's situated within walking distance of the University of Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, and also Chatham University. It's this place where, you know, a lot of college students flock to and gravitate to. And it's because the diversity is reflected not just in the people who visit there, but the people who live there.
No, seriously, like a shout out to Squirrel Hill, because just like it sounds,
yeah,
it sounds like the kind of community that, you know, forward thinking Americans would love to hang out in and fall in love in and eat in and pray in. And thank you for painting that picture. We really appreciate it.
You know, this attack happened only a few days after there was like 14 packages that contained pipe bombs, and they were sent to several politicians and prominent Democratic leaders. And in both cases, it's pretty clear that the motivation was hate. So, Mike, what's your read on these two cases? Is it too much of a stretch to start making a connection here? Because it feels to me like there's been enough examples now of this sort of domestic terrorism, and I'm not afraid to use those terms. So, Mike, what are your thoughts about what happened in Pittsburgh, and given the context of what we've been seeing?
And by the way, I'm starting to sweat already. I'm just like, oh, no, what's he going to say? Oh, no. How bad is it, Mike?
Obviously, it's horrible. And my sympathy goes to all the people in Squirrel Hill and Pittsburgh. And this was actually the third event of last week. There was also a double homicide in Kentucky where a man tried to go into a black church. So this could have been another massacre. When he couldn't get into the church, he went into a grocery store and killed two African-American shoppers. So this has been a problem. And what I have been warning about, and thank you for having me on the show a couple of times to talk about it, is how dangerous it is when authority figures like the President of the United States make appeals to these groups, these far-right groups that in the recent past have grown increasingly violent at public protests. So they've been dragged into the mainstream political discourse in a way that has empowered them. And I think, you know, the pipe bombing, the mail bombs, and the attack on the synagogue are different in many ways, right? I looked at the person charged with the pipe bomb, Caesar Sayoc, his online presence and the materials he had on his van, and you don't see the indicators of the far-right groups, right? The neo-Nazi groups, the sovereign citizen groups. So this—
So I just want to draw this out. So what you're saying, Mike, is in the case of the pipe bomber, Caesar Sayoc, his party allegiance was to Donald Trump and to the words of Donald Trump. His allegiance was not to the KKK, the white supremacists, the Republican Party. His allegiance was to the words and actions, or is to the words and actions, of Donald Trump.
Right. It appears, and again, there's a lot more we'll learn, but it appears that what was drawing him was the mainstream political discourse on the right, that was highlighting that the press was the enemy, that our political opponents are actually enemies trying to destroy our country. You know, it isn't surprising to me that the majority of the people he sent bombs to were persons of color. So this is kind of the product of inviting this angry, hostile group into the mainstream political discourse. And it's interesting with Robert Bowers, who's been accused of the homicides in Pittsburgh, that he was more part of the neo-Nazi milieu. And how the Trump campaign back in 2015 started basically using a bullhorn to tell them he was one of them, and more recently declared himself a nationalist, again, created this very dangerous atmosphere where these people feel that their violence is being sanctioned by authority figures. And it's interesting with Bowers because he was part of an element within this community that didn't trust Donald Trump to go far enough.
All right. So, Julio, on Sunday morning, before 10 o'clock in the morning, I was on the phone with Mike German.
Yeah.
Because I was about to go on MSNBC. So he was giving me this download. And Brenton, this is super interesting as well, in terms of a schism within the ultra right vis-a-vis Trump, and that what happened both in Pittsburgh as well as the pipe bombs are a manifestation of this schism. So what is the schism?
So I don't think most neo-Nazis and white supremacists, people who are actually part of that movement, part of those groups, feel that Donald Trump is exactly one of them, right? His outreach to the Israeli government, the fact that he has a Jewish daughter and son-in-law and grandchildren, but they were willing to accept him and support him because out of mutual exploitation, basically. He was exploiting them to create this angry base, and they were exploiting him because they could get half or three quarters of their agenda part of public policy. But there was a part of this movement that said, no, this is dangerous. This is somebody who is not one of us, who is not there to help us, and therefore we shouldn't support him. And this is what seems to be just viewing the social media of Robert Bowers, where he was.
And he was like, I'm not waiting any longer. I'm all in.
Right. But also influenced by the mainstream political discourse, right? When I was doing this work undercover in the 90s, the mainstream political discourse was white noise in the background. They had their own conversation about what was going on, where now it was very clear the hyping of the threat from this supposed caravan was definitely part of what was driving the neo-Nazi discourse about why this was becoming an emergency situation in which somebody had to act.
Brenton, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I worked at Southern Poverty Law Center for several years, and I unfortunately covered neo-Nazis and groups like this longer than I would have liked to. But when I did that work, that was about 10 years ago. This was around the time when a lot of neo-Nazi white supremacist, white nationalist groups were using online back channels as a way to kind of expand their ranks and also to have these different lines of discourse on what they thought was wrong with America. And I mean, I can say even back then, there were schisms and rifts between the various neo-Nazi and white nationalist groups. And these online forums were kind of like these places where like a lot of them would argue, right, over like who was the most authentic neo-Nazi, or,
right,
you know, or who was the most, you know, who could be the most racist, basically.
Right.
I can't believe like Mike and Brenton are like, yep, yep, seen that. Yep, yep. I'm just like, whoa, God.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So that's why I say this is kind of inevitable, right? Like eventually those back channel online arguments over who was the most authentic white nationalist was going to lead to events like the very ones that we're seeing. I mean, it, not just with Mike Bowers, where it's like, you know, fuck all of this. I'm just going to go in and shoot. You know, I mean, we had the same conversation. The same words came from Dylann Roof before he shot up the church in Charleston, the black church in Charleston. It was the same thing. He was making a claim that all of these neo-Nazis and neo-Confederates that he was talking with, they needed to stop talking and that somebody had to do something.
Hey, we're back, and you're listening to In the Thick. I'm Maria Hinojosa. With me is my co-host, Julio Ricardo Varela. We're joined by Brenton Mock and Mike German. Let's get back to the conversation. You know, a lot of this also, like the motivation of this, it's horrible, but, you know, the whole conversation about the caravan.
Yeah, the refugee
this
caravan,
This notion that it's like a caravan of, you know, I don't know what people are imagining, hundreds of thousands of people who are all gang members, you know, this whole kind of rhetoric, which is like not true. It's false. It's lies. This is not what's happening.
Right.
But it's intersecting right at this moment.
Yeah, it's perpetuated. And that's a point that I made with The Washington Post about how we've enabled sort of this rhetoric. So the president tells all these lies. The media is picking it up. And then you start seeing these messages that, you know, a Bowers or, you know, the pipe bomber suspect starts seeing. In the case of Bowers, Brenton, we see a clear connection because he did say, you know, fuck it, I'm going in. So what do you think about Trump's rhetoric, the lies being told. Is there a direct cause, in your opinion, that led to Squirrel Hill?
But hold on. Before you do that, Brenton, I just got to give the low key. Did you just hear what Julio did? He was like, as I mentioned to the Washington Post, low key, he's like, yes, I was cited in the Washington Post. And I'm just calling that out with a smile on my face.
You know, this is our show, Maria. If I can't shout out our work.
You got quoted in the Washington Post, bro, because we're so angry about the fact that people are not making these connections and allowing, in this case, people asking for refugee status, desperate women and children to be the fodder that leads to violence, potentially. I'm sorry, Brenton, go ahead.
In terms of Trump's rhetoric, like the lies that are coming out, the direct cause to Squirrel Hill, do you feel like it was a direct link?
I mean, yeah, there definitely was. And Adam Sorer, The Atlantic, I think he wrote an excellent piece that connected those dots. I think Mike German also made a good argument for this. But yeah, I know just from covering these guys years ago that they've been waiting for a messiah of sorts to break out into the wings and to kind of represent what they've been talking about at lower frequencies, to bring that into the spotlight, to embolden them, to empower them. And I think that as we are learning about Bowers, a lot of them have at least maybe initially saw that in Trump. And then after the events of Charlottesville, because, you know, this whole conversation about who's the most authentic white supremacist is just a, you know, downward death spiral. I think a lot of them just said, yeah, he's not enough. We got to take it farther. You know, I mean, I really think that Trump kind of blazed that path, but there's always going to be someone who's like, no, we have to make a more declarative statement. And I think that's all the more important why Trump has to make a more declarative statement. I mean, I think that he could stamp this out if he pursued white supremacists with the same gravitas, with the same aggression that he pursues, you know, caravans and people at the border.
Right.
I think that this could be stamped out. We have the resources and it's not like, you know, the FBI and other law enforcement agencies don't know that these guys are in the wings.
Before we go to you, Mike, I just want to quote from the Adam Sorer piece in The Atlantic. This is what he wrote, and it's pretty chilling. He says, much of the mainstream press abetted Trump's effort to make the midterm election a referendum on the caravan. It was an overwhelming topic of conversation on cable news, where Trumpists freely spread disinformation about the threat the migrants posed, while news anchors displayed exasperation over their false claims, only to then invite them back onto the next day's newscast to do it all over again.
Yep.
All right, Mike, that was just some context.
Right.
So you're on pins and needles because, yes, there is information about these kind of people.
Right. And Adam's been writing very well on this topic for months now. So I encourage people to go and read those. I think we have to be very careful when we talk about causes, right? Millions of people heard these messages. Hundreds of thousands of people are on these social media platforms that neo-Nazis and others participate in. And it's thankfully, knock wood, a small handful who actually commit violence. And when you look at them, often they were violent before they were part of some movement. You know, if you look at Cesar Sayoc, he had previously been arrested for making bomb threats, right? Long before he became a Trump fanatic. So I think what we have to understand, though, is that it's different when it's an authority figure who is giving the green light to this type of activity. And that's what has troubled me so much from the beginning of the Trump campaign, that he was encouraging the violence, that he was encouraging the anger, the sense of victimization, that we are under siege, that there are these foreign hordes that are coming in, whether they were Muslim, whether they were Latino. So that creates a very different condition. And then we saw all these far-right riots where the police lightly policed them. And I mean, we've seen police handle protests in extraordinarily aggressive manners in Standing Rock, in Ferguson, in Phoenix, in Washington, D.C., where they arrested 200 J-20 anti-Trump protesters and charged them all with felonies.
What's a J-20?
January 20th was the day after the inauguration when
January 20th.
Was a large anti-Trump rally and some windows got broken. And they went through trials. fortunately, juries saw through it and acquitted, and they finally dropped the cases. But how come we didn't see that same aggression targeting these groups? Mm. And now we're in a problem because ProPublica did some great reporting on the Rise Above movement, and Frontline aired a documentary this summer that finally coaxed the Joint Terrorism Task Force in taking action against this one small group they focused on. But if you look through Robert Bauer's Gab account, there are people saying, hey, the recent arrests of these groups show that the game is over, right? That our association with Trump is now broken and we have to start acting. And that, I think, is what I have been warning about, that at some point there was going to be a schism. And now these groups have had 2 years to organize, to recruit, to get stronger, and to feel empowered, and to feel that the police and authority figures are actually supporting their violence. And that's when this becomes really dangerous.
Yo, Julio, can you define GAB for us, please, for those of us who don't know?
Yeah, yeah. So you mentioned GAB, and it's a social media platform that essentially was created a couple of years ago for, quote unquote, free expression. But it's basically become a haven for white supremacists and the right wing. And that network was shut down, like, right after the shooting. And as of this recording, Gab is not an active social media network. But let me get back to Trump's rhetoric, because I guess he's trying to act presidential at this moment. But we know he has this history of encouraging hate and violence.
Before going any further, I want to address the horrible shooting that took place earlier today. This evil anti-Semitic attack is an assault on all of us. It's an assault on humanity. It will require all of us working together to extract the hateful poison of anti-Semitism from our world.
So that's Trump at this rally in Illinois on Saturday night, just hours after the shooting. He held a campaign rally after 11 people died. And, you know, even if you see that rally in his moment of apparent compassion, then he goes on and says this.
I could have had a little bit of an excuse. There was no excuses. We have our lives, we have our schedules, and nobody's going to change it, okay? So we're here. So let's have a good time. And if you don't mind, I'm going to tone it down just a little bit. Is that okay? No. you're from Illinois. I had a feeling you might say that.
So, on the one hand, you have his base that's promoting hate just as much as Trump. And then on the other hand, you still have Trump using the rhetoric of hate, even in the shadows of this cruel, tragic crime. I mean, that same Illinois rally, like, he attacks Maxine Waters, who's one of the Democratic representatives targeted from the pipe bombs. He later attacked commentator Bill Kristol. And then on Sunday, he tweeted against Tom Steyer, who's another target of the pipe bombs. So, Mike, are we just doomed to keep having more of these attacks while Trump's rhetoric continues?
And also, Mike, I mean, a lot of us have experienced a level of anxiety about the FBI. We've thought a lot more about the FBI than we ever have in our lives. What about the FBI in all of this, too?
It's troubling that the FBI has not been more aggressive when the state and local police have not been. When I first started seeing these very violent riots and the police weren't intervening, I assumed that, okay, maybe somebody made the determination that it would be even more dangerous for the police to try to intervene, let them separate, and we'll pick them up later. But that didn't happen for the better part of a year, and then has focused on only a few individuals rather than looking at this problem holistically. So I am concerned. I'm concerned with this reticence to use the word terrorism when we discuss far-right violence.
Is that a policy, like the FBI will not use the term terrorism, domestic terrorism, when tied to far-right violence?
So this goes back to Jim Comey refusing to call Dylann Roof's violence at the Mother Emanuel Church terrorism. And it's astonished me because I worked undercover in neo-Nazi groups in the 1990s, and nobody hesitated to call it terrorism. Nobody suggested we didn't have sufficient laws to justify our investigation and to secure effective prosecution. So I'm not sure where this came from, but there's this push right now that, again, has been going on since about 2015, where the Justice Department officials are saying we don't have a domestic terrorism statute, so we need more power if you want us to target these groups. And that's just not true. In fact, the Brennan Center is releasing a report this week that will show that, there are 57 crimes of terrorism defined in federal law. 51 of those apply to domestic as well as international terrorism. So the government has ample authority to justify deeper and more comprehensive investigations of these groups that produce violence. And again, there are lots of people who are neo-Nazis. There are lots of people who I met who fervently believed in these noxious ideas but would never harm anyone. We have to make sure we're focusing on the people who are violent and the people who are engaged in criminal activities in preparation of violence. Yeah. And that's what we did in the early 90s, and I'm surprised and dismayed that we're not more effective at that today, or even understanding this threat.
Feeling a little scared now.
Brenton, about the Trump rally, what are your thoughts? I mean, in terms of looking at what he's done in the last couple of days and how he's portraying himself as this quote-unquote national leader. Like Mike says, you know, they're responding to an authority figure. He's almost like justifying their acts.
I haven't been paying attention to the Trump rallies, to be honest with you. Mm. I think that's kind of what Trump wants you to do, right? It's this.
Why haven't you?
Well, mainly because I've been trying to focus on the people of Pittsburgh and how they've been responding. Pittsburgh has had some great rallies since the shooting. I mean, there have been several major vigils that happened in the Squirrel Hill neighborhood right outside of the Tree of Life Synagogue that literally filled almost the entire neighborhood, just kind of showing the strength and the resilience. I hate to sound cliche there, but like in moments like these, what Bowers wants you to do is, I mean, he wants people to feel intimidated. If you're not white, he wants you not to come out of your house. He wants you to be afraid. And so I think it's always a powerful symbolic show of strength when you see all of these people come out of their house and even come to the scene of the crime to show that, you know, we're not going to be afraid of you. And there have been just tremendous rallies showing that since then. To focus on Trump is, again, to kind of do his bidding. You know, he wants to control the narrative. He wants to be the one framing the story. And quite frankly, a lot of people in the media, we fall for it, right? Like, yeah. we take our eye off of what is supposed to be important to report and sound off and comment on whatever cockamamie thing that Trump just said.
I asked the question. I fell for it, too.
So, Mike, what do we do? Like, there is this, yes, this surge of love and community, the recognition that this is the largest ever assassination of Jewish people in the United States in history. And there is a lot of unity and conversation. But in terms of kind of counteracting the hate, what can a person do, a community do? What's your recommendation, Chief FBI, former agent?
So one of the things that I was very pleased about was one of the largest of the Pittsburgh rallies was actually organized by young people. And I think that's something important, that we have a generation of people coming up who are rejecting these ideas and are working, organizing within communities. And I think that's the answer that, you know, I don't think President Trump is going to change. You know, it seems that the Republicans in Congress have backed him at every turn, no matter how dangerous the outcome has been. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. So, you know, it's up to us to organize and to protect our own communities, to work through local government, to work through city and state government. There are initiatives in San Francisco and Oakland and Portland to bring their local polices out of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, expressing their concern about the methods the FBI is using, particularly to target communities of color unfairly. So there are ways we can, within our system, resist this kind of federal government imposition of these horrible ideas and policies. And it's a matter of protecting one another and protecting our communities.
All right, so for our final segment, we're going to take a quick temperature check.
So we are a week away from the midterms, and it's a moment that is really key for this country. Right now, the stretch to Election Day has been marked by hate, by violence, by attacks, by threats. So how are you personally feeling about what's going to come in the next days, particularly in terms of communities of color? Let's start with you, Mike.
Well, at the top of my mind is that this is not going to get better soon. that even if the Trump administration and the Republicans in Congress came out strongly and said, we've been wrong for the last 2 years and want to turn this around, there is this very angry, energized base that feels violence is not only justified, it's necessary. So putting that back into the bottle, I think, is going to be very difficult. You know, and I don't want to sensationalize. I mean, terrorism is still very rare. You're more likely to get hurt on your way to and from work in a car than you are to be injured by a terrorist. But, you know, law enforcement, unfortunately, seems to have a blind spot with this kind of organized criminal activity and organized violence. And we need to make sure that they understand this threat much better than they do.
Brenton.
I'm concerned for a lot of things. Midterms are coming up, and we've already seen many different forms of voter suppression and voter intimidation happening against people of color, which is its own form of political violence. But people of color who are motivated to get out and vote because of recent events are very concerned about what they'll meet at the polls, what kind of confrontations. And polling stations are very contested grounds at every major election. So my thoughts are also with the friends and family members of those who were killed on Saturday. And I know a lot of people who are close to those people. So it's going to be hard for them to move forward because there's no guarantee that it's over. Guys like Bowers and Dylan Roof, they become martyrs for young neo-Nazis waiting in the wings who want to take it further. And so when you talk about like what a city like Pittsburgh can do to counter this, as I wrote in my article, I think Squirrel Hill really is a model for that. And I think that they should double down on that. The type of segregation that you see in Pittsburgh, they really need to take a look at the welcoming and inclusive environment that Jewish families have had in Squirrel Hill to incorporate so many different nationalities and cultures and races into that neighborhood and try to find a way to replicate that around the city. And Pittsburgh could be a model for other cities.
Well, you know what I say? Long live Squirrel Hill.
Yeah.
Never thought I'd be saying that. And I also want to say these names: Jerry Rabinowitz, brother Cecile and David Rosenthal, Rose Malinger, married couple Bernice and Sylvan Simon, Daniel Stein, Joyce Feinberg, Richard Gottfried, Melvin Wax, and Irving Younger. All of them killed in the worst attack against the Jewish community in the United States. Some of those had actually survived the Holocaust, only to be killed in the United States because they're Jewish. It's a very sad, sad time, but we really appreciate Brenton Mock for joining us. Because you're a Pittsburgher, we send out a lot of love and support to you. In particular, you're a staff writer at City Lab, Mike German, fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program at NYU, former FBI agent. Thanks to the both of you for joining Julio and me on this episode of In the Thick.
Great. Thanks. And thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Remember, people, to go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us, because it really helps other listeners to find us. Also, follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at In The Thick Show. Find a way to like us on Facebook. Yes. And also tell your family and friends to listen. We really appreciate it. In The Thick is produced by Juan Pablo Garnham, Stephanie Lebeau, and Nicole Rothwell. The music that you heard is courtesy of Nacional Kept and ZZK Records. We thank you so much for choosing to listen to In The Thick. Hasta la próxima. Chao.
Nos vemos.
Mike, can you tell us what you had for breakfast and say hello to Brenton?
Just a cup of coffee for breakfast. Hello, Brenton.
Tough ass Mike German, it's a former FBI agent. Just a cup of coffee.
I know, he's just like, cup of coffee. It was black. And I still, you know, like all FBI agents, I just paid a quarter for it.
Yeah, exactly. I got one of those like New York City Greek coffee cups.
Oh my God.